The HIV Hour is on the first and third Thursday at 7 p.m, repeated throughout the month. Check Radio Reverb's schedule on the website radioreverb.com at 97.2 FM DAB+. Our social pages are Twitter and Instagram at HIV_hour, and join our Facebook page at HIV Hour Reverb. Contact us on hivhour@gmail.com, and you can listen and subscribe to our famous podcast. Type in HIV Hour at Spotify, iTunes and Deezer. To listen to the full HIV Hour show, go to our website, Listen Again page. The HIV Hour, positively helping to change hearts and minds.
Hello, good evening and welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, we're in the studio.
In the studio.
Well done for that, Stephen.
It's very nice to be here.
How are you doing? How is everyone?
Yes, it's sunny in Brighton at the moment, so that is really nice, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
How long it will be for is another matter, but it's just puts a smile on your face, doesn't it, Stephen?
It certainly does. It's nice to have a bit of sun for a change.
When were you in Brighton last, Stephen?
I was last in Brighton probably about 4 or 5 months ago, Josh, so it's been a while. I remember that it was very chilly when I was here last time, so it's nice to be a bit warmer this time round.
Yes, we're getting there, aren't we? Mm. So how are you, Sue? You got some news, haven't you?
Ooh. Well, I have got some news. I may have mentioned on a previous show that my daughter was expecting a baby, and little Bodie arrived a few days ago.
Bodie, yes,
I know. That's
what a cute name.
And I'm still not getting over it, because it's you know, I remember when my daughter was born 25 years ago, and it was a miracle. Every child that is born is a miracle, in my opinion. And when I was looking down at Bodie when I went to see him in hospital the other day. They are home now, which is great. And that's a human being that needs to be protected, not just from human beings, but from the world. I know I get all think when I see, you know, especially with my daughter's little one. And it just makes me want to do more to make sure that he has a better life to look forward to, as in, you know, stigma, discrimination, the things we really talk about and want to make sure that we change things for the future. And I really, you know, it's just I'm getting all sort of googie gaga now. But, yeah, it's a reminder that, you know, Bodie and his generation, we want to make sure that life is different and the world is different.
And having heard your story many times, so when you know, you're talking about your daughter, and when she found out you were positive, and her response, and to now think that she's a mother must be really weird.
It's quite surreal, actually. So, and it's beautiful. So that I'm still coming to terms with the being in awe.
Are you going to be granny or nanny?
I'm going to be Northern Nana.
Northern Nana.
Northern Nana.
Northern Nana. Yes. Yeah.
I'm going to call you Grandmama.
We're going to call you Naughty Nana.
Naughty Nana.
We've got it there, still sorted. Yeah. So no David or Tony today, but they're with us in spirit, aren't they?
Yes,
so
absolutely. Yes.
And Stephen, how are you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Life's busy, hectic, but that's good. What have I been doing?
You know,
when somebody says, "What have you been doing?" And I'm like, "I've got no idea, but I know I've been busy." So yeah, life is good. Life is good.
Oh, that's good. I'm okay. I've had some work done at my place. My brother's been brilliant. Oh. He's creating a nice studio in my garage, I've got loads of records, so I can get them up. So I'm waiting for that.
Oh, you haven't padded walls and things like that?
Yeah, I think it's all been... It's done the work. What are you trying to say?
I know it's
Mental Health Awareness Week, but...
I know. I meant it in the best possible taste, as Everett used to say, but yes.
The best possible taste.
Exactly.
It's going to be... he's done a floor and he's done...
Lovely.
All insulated ceilings and what do you call it? Do you know what? It's all those Speakers.
The flute.
It's just floating shelves. Thanks.
Floating shelves. Oh yes, yes.
Yeah, so it's on floating shelves. So it's getting there.
Oh, just, lovely.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Wonderful.
Yes. So we got what we got on the show. We just I think because we're all in the studio and it's great to have Stephen in because he hasn't been in the studio before. Mm-hmm. We're going to just do some stories, aren't we? And,
and
get together
and have a chat about stuff and just because it's nice to be in the moment, isn't it?
It certainly is. Yep.
Just chatting in the studio. So yeah.
Well, you're doing a talk today, you two, aren't you?
Yes, we're at Patcham High School in Brighton, one of our favourite schools we go to. So after the show, we'll be running up there.
Zooming off there, yeah.
Yeah.
So should we get on with you? So your the first song is a request from you, Sue. So
yes,
do you want
it
to just tell the listeners about it?
Yes, well, it's by Stevie Wonder. And it's called Isn't She Lovely? But obviously, I think, you know, he talked about his child being born in the song, and it's such a beautiful song.
Yeah.
So I know it says, Isn't She Lovely? But, you know, Isn't He Lovely? And obviously, it's dedicated to my grandson and also, obviously, my sister and her partner because, you know, it's because of them that he's here and it's just a celebration that he's been born. So, yeah, I just thought of that.
Fabulous, let's listen to it. So welcome back to the HIV Hour. Yeah, so we were just talking about my injectables, weren't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were wondering how your bottom is.
My posterior is fine.
Good. Mm-hmm. Have you been getting on with it?
So I've just had my sixth injection, so I started in August.
Right.
Oh, really good, I'm undetectable.
Yeah,
the thing what was, you know, it's after when you have your insight what's going to feel like. But I've got no pain afterwards because usually it was like a week after I'd be quite sore and where in the injection site. Mm-hmm. But now I'll be fine. I realise what you do is you don't do much on that day and you take like ibuprofen and I've been putting like some cream on it and it's been fine and no pain afterwards. Yeah, it seems really good.
Good.
We're getting there. It's all good stuff. Were you thinking about it, Stephen?
Yeah, well, because of my diabetes, I have a lot of stomach problems and I get quite nauseous a lot of the time. And there are times when I'm not able to take my meds.
Wow.
So my doctor was speaking to me recently and she said, Stephen, it might be an idea for you. So I'm in the process of looking at it.
Definitely.
And they're going to look at it and see. Because I was saying to Josh earlier on, so, you know, there's times you go into hospital and sometimes they don't know HIV meds are, you know, and they don't seem to be as urgent on those meds as they are maybe with your blood pressure meds or those kind of things.
Yeah.
So to not have that worry, you know, would be great, you know, to know that you've got the drug in your system.
You must investigate about that, and that may be really quite good for you. So, yeah.
I think, you know, thinking about it, I've been talking about it. I went in the Beaver Conference and stuff, and it's early days, isn't it? And any new treatment will take a while for it to develop, and you just have to ask yourself whether it's good for you and you can live, because you do go into the clinic a lot more, but it's just weighing it up. What's best for you, isn't it? Really,
And the advances, Josh, there'll be in it.
Yes.
You know, in a year's time, it's probably going to be. You know, there's going to be some. They'll have honed it and worked it out even better, so that you know, there will be advances.
Yeah. So I keep talking about my posterior.
Keep us
for the foreseeable future. So we're going to do some world stories and some. You've got the first story, haven't you, Sue?
Yes. This piece of story information, whatever you want to call it, comes from NAM and AIDS Map. And apparently over 40% prevalence of precancerous cervical lesions among female sex workers with HIV in South Africa, but most unaware of the disease. So basically, despite low screening rates, 42% of South African female sex workers with HIV were found to have high-risk pap tests, meaning they showed signs of developing cervical cancer, in the INTEREST 2023 conference in Maputo, Mozambique, heard this week. So the prevalence of cervical cancer procures lesions in the cohort of mostly HIV-positive sex workers were higher than the average reported for African women between 5 to 30% with low screening uptake. So basically, cervical cancer caused by the HPV virus, the second most common cancer and the leading cause of cancer-related deaths in South African women. Female sex workers living with HIV have a high risk of acquiring cervical cancer due to the nature of their work and compromised immunity, especially when not adhering to HIV treatment and it's having condomless sex. The researchers used Pap tests from sex workers' dedicated health centres in Johannesburg between June 2019 to September 2022 in their analysis. And the women uptake of the cervical cancer screener was only 4%. And the investigators included 104 satisfactory Pap tests in the final analysis. Now, obviously, as a woman myself living with HIV, I have a cervical smear test every single year. And I've had a couple of scares, to be quite honest, guys. I've had a couple of procedures where they've seen sort of cancerous cells on my cervix. Now, they would have only have seen that because I'm of a woman of an age that I no longer have smear tests. So that is why it's important. And this is a bit of a shout out for all women with a cervix to make sure that you get your yearly smear test, because as I say, I've always been quite a good at tests and so forth, but when you know, a woman living with HIV, she is invited to have a smear test every year because of the you know, the immune system, and we're more prone, to be quite honest. So, and obviously they're doing some work in South Africa, and obviously, you know, there's a major high prevalence of cervical smears, and you know, people being unnecessarily diagnosed with cervical cancer. So, yeah.
And this is in Africa, you're saying?
Mozambique, yeah. Yeah, this is some research, and you know, has just come through. They've been doing where, and female sex workers, which is their living, and and maybe sometimes they may not be taking their medication due for whatever reason, but they have to still carry on their job as it, you know, they're living, they're putting the food on the table. And so, I mean, support and stuff is getting out there, but I think it's just a shout out for every woman, actually, living with HIV, that, you know, if I hadn't had that yearly test checkup, I mean, well, I'm not even going to say. So it's just a shout out, I think, for all the ladies with a cervix to go and get checked out, and make sure you get checked out. And
it's really important, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. You know, and you're on your health, and, you know, we've got enough to contain with, haven't we?
But so is it different people with HIV then, or do you think these...
Sorry, say that again.
Is it different for people with women with HIV?
Yes, I mean, so basically, of a woman my age, not living
21.
Yeah, 21. would not be offered, at the age of 64, you stop getting invited in for screening.
Okay.
Yeah. But if you're HIV positive, you will still get invited in.
Okay.
You're right? That's a point I'm trying to make.
That's a good one.
Because of, you know, and it's the medication, and also that, you know, with the immune system as well, and it thins the lining of the cervix and in the womb.
Right.
You see, so it makes it more acceptable for possible. That's why you need, and you know, they can catch those cells quick. They can burn them off. They can, you know, do all sorts of things. So really important. Yeah.
And this is like for all of us, isn't it? With
with absolutely
with chicks. Older,
Like me and David did that Bechtel study. So it's all kind of getting checked, isn't it, when you're HIV because of these issues, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, definitely, absolutely. Yeah.
So should we have another song?
Shall we?
Yeah.
So this is from Tony. So we asked Tony because he's not in today, but we asked him, and he wanted a Kylie.
He likes a bit of Kylie.
We all like a bit of Kylie. Yeah.
So this is All the Lovers.
Dance. Radio Reverb.
Welcome back to the HIV Hour. That was Kylie with a bit of All the Lovers. That was Tony's choice, wasn't it? His request.
Yes, it certainly was.
So I've got a story from Kyrgyzstan.
Right.
Where is Kyrgyzstan? It's, what used to be a Russian... Yeah, I think it is in that bulk.
Gosh,
yeah.
Arsene's job.
We're always shaking our shoulders, aren't we?
Shaking their heads. So they could lose out on $29 million in international funding for HIV prevention and treatment after MPs scrapped a working group for going against traditional values. So Kyrgyzstan's cabinet of ministers approved the dissolution of the country's coordinating committee to fight HIV and AIDS. So tuberculosis and malaria after coming under pressure from hardline MPs at the end of April. The MPs denounced the committee's distribution of condoms to men who have sex with men as part of the HIV programme, which is largely financed by the Global Fund, the world's largest fund of prevention, treatment and care programmes for these three diseases. That work, the Cabinet's Deputy Chair said, does not correspond to national traditions. Yes.
Really?
What does that mean?
Exactly.
Is it the same as Margaret Thatcher and John Major said?
Yeah.
Traditional values, wasn't
it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So in recent years, this sentiment has often been used to stifle debate about social issues, be it women's or LGBT plus rights, representing them as threats to their country's traditional values.
Right.
Without it, a wide range of initiatives to prevent HIV and guarantee access to free healthcare for people with HIV and AIDS could end. Mm-hmm. Experts and people living with the condition told, this is from Open Democracy, so that's where the story comes from, people will die if the funding is lost.
Gosh.
So it's quite a serious thing, isn't it?
I think it really is.
I think sometimes we forget how lucky we are in this country.
I know, we do.
Within a year, the entire system for diagnosing HIV and tuberculosis will begin to collapse. So this is from Deputy Chair of the HIV and AIDS Coordinating Committee Board. Around 70% of the fund's grant to Kyrgyzstan goes on HIV and AIDS programmes. So it's quite a lot of funding, isn't it? And there is an estimated 12,500 people living with HIV and AIDS in Kyrgyzstan. So I've seen the stigma. So it's about stigma against people with this chronic disease, isn't it? It's about stigma, isn't it?
Exactly.
At the end of the day. So Anna, I can't get her surname right, so I'm gonna. I'll just call her Anna.
Yeah.
She said, "Once my husband, who has AIDS, and her came to the hospital, and the doctor said to them, 'Why are you hanging around with this AIDS person? He will die anyway.'" Oh dear. So that moment, she says, it made her realise that she wanted to set an example for others by being open about her own diagnosis. So stigma is a major obstacle for those who would like to share their pain and ask for support. I mean, that's all we want, really.
Exactly.
We just want people to support us and understand us, not?
Yeah.
And especially the government, who you kind of want to be there for, you know.
Yeah.
People are afraid they will be misunderstood, fired from their jobs, or kicked out of their homes. The stereotypes from the 1990s that we've talked about on the show, that HIV is transmitted through day-to-day contact. So, Anna is particularly concerned about how the healthcare system treats people, claiming that confidentiality about diagnosis is often not respected in medical institutions.
It's like going back to the 80s, isn't it?
Yes.
You know,
what's it about? If one doctor tells another one about a patient's HIV status, the whole hospital will soon know about it.
Gosh.
People cannot understand and accept that HIV is a chronic disease. So,
And this is a recent story. Can I just...
Yeah, this is...
I thought I'd just get you to clarify. It is recent,
As if they've not had it... hard enough, you know, with all the war and things like that over there. It's crazy.
So, but the antiviral therapy, which blocks the reproduction of the HIV virus in the body, helps prevent the development of AIDS, which we know. If they start the drug regime early enough, people can live a long and fulfilling life, relationships, family and careers. So it kind of has a go at that, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
You're trying to go through that and you're trying to live through with your medication and you've got that against you. So just a couple more bits about that. If funding is stopped, people will not be able to find out whether their treatment is effective or not. There won't be any chance to test for drug resistance either. So shutting off access to treatment, testing and prevention is stupid. This is what Anna said. If people start dying from HIV infection, nothing will help them. The only thing that can help is the medication. Mm-hmm. And if they're taking that away, it's going to be...
And knowing as well if you're undetectable, all those kind of things, that, you know, if there's no access to, you know, to those services,
And this is going to push people back underground, how are they going to...
It's surprising, even in some countries around the world, they're still not looking at the scientific evidence, because this is what we're talking about, the scientific proven evidence, what a tablet can do, you know.
Yeah, but it goes deeper than that. It's about stigma. It's about people's feelings towards people with HIV.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was reading an article about Uganda as well, you know, and about how that's pushing people, gay people underground because of the laws that have been brought in there. Mm-hmm. And people that are HIV positive as well, it's even more scary a place for them to be, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are very lucky here.
Yeah, definitely. Your story, Stephen.
My story is HIV advocacy on TikTok. Ooh. Do you use TikTok, Sue? It's this thing that the kids use. I don't use it.
No, I'm not a TikToker.
You're not a TikToker.
I'm not a TikToker.
What is TikTok?
Yeah, what is TikTok?
Can you explain that to me, please?
Yeah. It's a social media platform. And about all I know about it. So there's no denying the growing power and influence of TikTok with 1 billion active users globally. The short-form video app has been steadily gaining users since its launch in 2016, with a notable surge in the past few years amid the COVID-19 pandemic. The global head of agency accounts at TikTok defines the app as an entertainment platform rather than a social network. TikTok users can while away hours watching short videos of dance challenges, lip syncs, makeup tutorials, workouts, recipes, pranks, and more. TikTok is not without controversy. The app was launched by the Chinese company ByteDance, and by law, the Chinese government can comply with the company to share the data. But there are some people who are using TikTok to continue telling their stories and using it as a platform. Oliver Wang, TikTok's features his hilarious stand-up stories about life in Southern California, racism, changes in groovy dancing, but his most viewed videos are about HIV. The Taiwanese native came to the States 7 years ago and attended film school and tested positive for HIV 2 years later. 2 months ago, two months after his diagnosis, he started chronicling his HIV journey on TikTok. In a video, he's gained over 556,000 views.
Wow.
Wong talks about how he discovered he was living with HIV within 2 to 6 weeks of his HIV infection. He says in the video, "You develop flu-like symptoms." So he believes he was infected in November 2020. He goes on to describe the symptoms he started feeling a month or so later, which he thought might have been due to COVID. And it wasn't until February 21 when he went to get tested for his annual sexually transmitted infections, when he found out that he had HIV. Wong was using TikTok before he had HIV, and as a stand-up comedian, he says, "One of my jobs is to be honest and sincere as I can be on stage so people can relate to me. Once I got HIV, I was like, I don't want to hide. I don't want to be funny on stage without disclosing. There's a secret inside me, which is HIV. Because he already exposes so much of his life, his parents, his Asianness, his sexuality, in his stand-up and on social media, it was only natural for him to add HIV to the mix. I started writing jokes about HIV, then I started to talk about it on stage. He says, then after a month or two, I started to translate those jokes to TikTok. Wong, who also works as a director of straight adult films, has found that using TikTok has helped him deal with his diagnosis. It's a really therapeutic experience for me to make peace with my status as an HIV positive person, he says. And I think about talking about it in public, it really helps me to accept with what I'm dealing with, it is actually a reality. As for making jokes about HIV, Wong says, it's a soft way to get people to pay attention. Humour lets people ease into a heavy topic such as HIV, he says. By making HIV a topic so light and digestible, I believe that more people are able to listen and absorb. Most people associate HIV with death, which is not the case anymore, with the modern medical advances, so I think that using humour to talk about it can reverse people's assumptions.
I think that's very true, isn't it?
It's about using social media in a very positive way, if you excuse the pun.
No, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and I really get what he said when he said, you know, he doesn't want his way of sort of projecting what HIV is not to make it scary. And so he's going to, you know, he's sort of, not necessarily in a jokey way, but in a sort of a humorous way to get it across. And I really get that.
It's all about breaking down barriers, isn't it?
In whatever way, shape, or form is your strength.
How do you get on the contact again?
Yes, so it is Oliver Wong, and he's on TikTok. Oliver lives in Los Angeles now, so at Oliver Wong Comedy is his handle or whatever they use on TikTok.
It's all different ones.
At Oliver Wong Comedy, so you can check him out there.
Fabulous. So it's time for your request, Stephen.
I am going to have Baby Was a Dancer by the wonderful advocate Billy Porter.
Well, let's have a listen. Welcome back to the HIV Hour. That was Billy Porter, and Baby Was a Dancer. So it's a new track, isn't it, Steve?
Yeah, it's just come out, so it's very boppy, isn't it?
Yeah, it's good, that
one.
Just to say, if you want to come on the show, contact us at hivhour@gmail.com, or go to our Facebook page, which is at HIV Hour Reverb, if you want to join that, and also Twitter and Instagram at HIV_hour. Excuse you, Sue. So I've got a story. It's an oldish, well, it's not oldish, it's April, really, but that's not, in news terms, that's probably quite a long time ago. Australia on track to become one of the first countries in the world to eliminate HIV. Have you read that?
Yes, I've heard something about it.
So it's been a 10-year study that has found that Australia could become one of the first countries to virtually eliminate HIV transmissions, with new infections decreasing dramatically. The findings published in The Lancet HIV show that HIV infections decreased by 66% between 2010 and 2019 in New South Wales and Victoria, while there was a 27% rise in people accessing effective HIV treatment. Increased access to HIV treatment and PrEP, that's pre-exposure prophylaxis.
You got it, Josh.
The medication that prevents a person from contracting HIV was cited as a key reason for the decreased transmissions. The journal also endorsed the public health strategy treatment as prevention, which reduces a person's risk of transmitting HIV to another person to zero. What do we think about that?
You wonder, what are they doing, you know, because obviously we've set the goal for 2030, for no new infections, and so it would be great if countries could work together, wouldn't it, you know, to make a global, but it's great news that they're making those steps, and that there are those changes from 2010 to 2019. That's quite a good chunk of you know, people that are accessing treatment and things.
So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be great if the world could get together and sort of come up with a date where we can all work towards? I know the UK is wanting to be the first country in the world to end all cases of HIV by 2030. But whether we'll get there is another, but we seem to be on track. But perhaps if we were to be the only country in the world for the first one, maybe that could be another benchmark where we could get together with other countries to, you know, to talk about it in a world situation.
We need a we are the world type
song.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
What should be doing.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm copywriting that. But yeah, do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, it's something that really brings HIV to the forefront to let people know that it's still there, you know.
Well, when I get my new studio,
yeah, with your padded walls,
padded walls,
my padded cell,
we'll
sort it out.
Yeah,
and we can all, and soon me and Tony can be backing singers.
Me and Billy Porter will do the
David. Yeah,
yeah.
Billy Porter, we'll get Billy Porter in the roles. So, Dr. Denton Callender, who works obviously in research in America, in Australia, says we found that over time a viral suppression increased HIV incidence decreased. Indeed, every percentage point increase in successfully treated HIV saw a fivefold decrease in new infections. So the Professor Mark Stuve, I think I've got that right, added that the success of Australian measures such as education on HIV and reduced patient treatment costs, and that could see the country virtually eliminating new HIV transmissions. HIV experts have explained how medical breakthroughs have transformed the treatment and prevention of the virus, which we, you know, injectables and PrEP. And,
yep.
And the U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmissible slogan, aims to tackle the misconception that people with HIV can pass on the virus on even if they are receiving effective treatment. So again, we know that, don't we? So. Just talk about in the UK, actually. In the UK, former Health Secretary Matt Hancock committed to ending new HIV transmissions by 2030, which he did, didn't he? Mm-hmm. However, charities and activists have warned this won't happen without better utilisation of all the tools.
Yes. Very true.
Correct.
Richard Agel, who's been on the show, Chief Executive of the Tenancy Trust, he told Pink News that it's possible but not probable. So it's supposed to be realistic as well, isn't it, I suppose?
Mm-hmm. And the way things are with the cost of living crisis and the government and things like that, we need an input of cash and funding to really, you know, get out there and just be seen.
Yeah.
Plodding on with it.
I mean, I think if we were to literally be touching it by 2030, I think that would still be an achievement.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we don't want to say, you know, in 2030 and get to it and we haven't reached it and then everything goes out the window. I think the attitude still has to be that's an achievement.
That we're working towards it
and to look at literally what we've done to try and achieving that.
Yeah.
So I think we need to sort of be holding steadfast on, oh, well, if 2030 doesn't happen, let's just not think about it anymore. I think we really have to be on track. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not a negative thing. Just
absolutely.
Reach the target, is it?
Yeah,
it's just
And it is...
Yeah.
Things happen.
Yeah.
And it is 7 years away. You kind of think, well, you know, who knows? Yeah. You know...
A lot can happen in seven days,
can't it? You know, let alone 7 years.
I want to know who this who is, because he knows a lot.
Who knows?
My friend Kevin says
Mr. Who or Miss Who or Mimi.
Who knows?
Who knows?
He's very intelligent.
We'll need to get Who in for an interview.
Yes.
Hey, and welcome back to the HIV Hour, 97.2 FM. And we're going to go into community news now, aren't we, Josh?
Yeah, Sue. Pass it on to Sue first.
Yeah. Just a little bit of... I thought I'd just talk a bit about the Sussex Beacon.
Brilliant.
Apparently there's a new CEO. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know.
I
knew Bill had gone.
Bill had gone some time ago, and we've got they've got a new CEO. I thought I'd just sort of mention. His name is Matthew Dendy. And apparently he's the interim CEO. I'm not quite sure what that means, but he's...
He's like this...
Temporary. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So having originally joined the Sussex Beacon Board of Trustees in 2022, Matthew has more than 35 years' experience in commercial and project management. More recently, his focus has been on the analysis and approval of business development and project proposals. His expertise also includes risk management, helping small organisations compile and review business continuity and crisis management plans. Matthew has supported not-for-profit organisations, including the Food Chain and the Cancer Backup, for more than 25 years, both as a volunteer and advisor. And just a bit of news about the Sussex Beacon, and they do so much. Haven't they just recently had their 30th anniversary?
It's 30 years.
30 years in Beverndean, overlooking amazing views, support lots of other services. They've got, you know, they have a women's group once a month. And if you want, you know, you can contact the Sussex Beacon for any information on 01273 694 222.
The thing I did was the drag queen for a day.
Yes, that's right.
So that was amazing. I think they're going to do another one. So stay tuned
to that.
It was
really successful, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was just like, just tapping into that side of you. And it was so well done. And
I was surprised because we had a conversation about this. And I said, is it only guys that can do it?
No. Anybody can do it.
Good.
You know, I think it's just unveiling that inner drag queen or king or...
Okay,
just an interesting query.
Would you go for it?
Depends how I'm feeling on the day. But it was a query question I wanted to ask.
Yes, fair enough. Would you do it, Stephen?
I'd love to do it. I really would, because I think it's another... of being a performer, it's another part of something that you can tap into. But I would need somebody to do my makeup because...
Yeah, you get given a local drag queen or king or somebody to help you with...
Right,
getting that
to guide you.
Aesthetic.
Oh, right.
Good.
And you've got some news.
Yeah, so also Sussex Beacon. So local HIV charity, the Sussex Beacon and the Brighton Rainbow Fund will be the beneficiaries of funds raised from this year's Brighton Bear Weekend, which is one of the biggest events on the community calendar that takes place this year from Thursday the 6th of July to Sunday the 9th of July. Following a very successful Brighton Bear Weekend Easter quiz at the Camelford Arms, the Mr. Brighton Bear competition has now been launched. Arguably the real highlight of the week, though, is the legendary Brighton Bear Weekend garden party for which people will travel from around the UK. And I've heard that they've got quite a cool DJ.
Yeah, I don't know his name. I can't remember.
It's Josh.
There's a few of us, actually. There's Rob C. from London. I don't know if you know Rob C. And Barrett's there DJing. But there's a few things going on. So keep an eye out.
Can I ask you a question?
Oh, no. Go on.
Will you be going in for the Mr. Bear?
No.
I don't think so. No?
No.
Oh.
Do you think I should?
I think because you're gorgeous and tall and...
you could do it, Josh.
Lovely legs.
I don't know what the criteria is.
You need a beard.
Oh, you've got a little bit of the one there.
Yeah. Moving on.
So if you want more information on that, go to brightonbearweekend.com.
No, it's a good event, and it's all good for... I mean, last year, I've DJed over the last few years. It's just really good, and it gets really busy, and the garden part is great.
Sounds fun.
Yeah, check it out on the website, and you can buy merchandise and T-shirts and stuff. So it all goes towards a good cause.
HIV Hour is the UK's only show for people living with HIV, sharing stories, news and views on living positively with the virus.
Hello there. I'm delighted to welcome Mark Stevens to the show. Mark, we were introduced to each other through Sue, one of our co-presenters. Hello, person. Hello, Tina. How do you know Sue?
Hello, back to you, Dave. Well, quite by accident. I had been aware of Positive Voices for a little while over the last couple of years, and I got in touch with them after It's a Sin, because I was talking to a young colleague at work. I retired last October, but this was after It's a Sin came out, and he's a young gay man, about 32, and he turned to me and he said, "You didn't really have it that bad, did you?" And I have to say, I was mortified, really. Yeah, that such a large section of our history had been forgotten. And so after I sat him down and talked him through, I decided, well, perhaps this is an educated man. He's a psychologist. My goodness, if he doesn't know, what does that mean for everybody else? And so I thought, I need to do something about this, and got in touch with TH2, who recommended Positive Voices, and who got me in touch with Sue.
It's marvellous. I mean, positive speakers are great. They go into schools and workplaces, don't they? And I suppose, you know, talking about the times you were talking about, which It's a Sin represented, quite dark times, it's living history, isn't it?
It is living history. And I wanted the opportunity to bring that back to people, particularly people who might not be aware of it. Because I think these days, the whole AIDS agenda has become more about reducing transmission and getting past this, and so that we don't have AIDS or HIV anymore. Yeah. And I was really concerned that, well, what about us?
Yeah.
Are we losing our history? Are we losing our identity? Are we losing our visibility? So I started doing some talks with Sue, and I wasn't very successful, I think, because for me, it's a very present past. And I tend to sort of go towards the horror of it. But what particularly annoyed me was people would say afterwards, "What a brave man." And that so annoyed me. This is not about being brave. This is about you listening to the story and recognizing what went on and recognizing the contribution of these people, which if we hadn't gone through that, if we hadn't been the guinea pigs, if we hadn't set up those organisations, we wouldn't have what we've got today. We have what we have today, and I'm not just talking about our infrastructure, I'm talking about our medication. We have very good medication these days. We didn't just get that medication. We started off with AZT and DDI and DDC, and these are just bloody awful drugs. And we sort of smoothed it out until we got to protease inhibitors, which were, again, were a lifesaver, but with the most catastrophic side effects. So for me, it was about being a positive voice speaker, was about trying to redress the balance. Because I mean, there are lots of things online, but people don't know about them. So the way to do that is to talk. And then that sort of streamed into other issues. I went back to work in 2000. And I just lost the HIV identity. I did not want to be around HIV, not the HIV person. I just lost myself in my work. And I got a life back. And I just completely lost touch with the HIV scene. It's when HIV It's a Sin came out, and I thought, fantastic, this is a great program. When that program came out, I thought, I needed to address the issue that we talked about earlier. So I was completely shocked and surprised by how little is known about that past.
I mean, it's a real catalyst for restarting the conversation in the UK, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I mean, we have to remember it was entertainment. For me, you see, that guy's life in that show, that was my life, as it was for a lot of people. So for me, it was real entertainment, because I don't suppose it was trying to be anything more. And the benefit of having something in an entertainment format is that people are going to watch it again, as opposed to a docudrama. And that's a great benefit. It did generate that conversation. But what it didn't do was didn't give an idea of the scale of it.
Yeah.
Nor of the horror of it, because it was, I've never seen corpses die so well. What it captured beautifully, I think, was the relationship between gay young men and the mother or the parents. Yeah. And that for me was what the story was about. But in terms of what it did, it generated a lot of interest, and that's fantastic. You cannot take that away from Russell Davies. But for me, it didn't. It was almost like an asymptomatic portrayal of that time. So I am on a bit of a mission. I do want to tell people, look, it was a pretty dire period for all of us, whether you're unaffected, affected, gay, straight. It was horrible. And that's why I'm talking to you today, and that's why HIV Long-Term Awareness Survivors Day is really important to me, because it sort of gets us back to that particular past, which we are in danger of losing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the gist of it, is National Long-Term Survivors Day in the USA. I'm not aware, and I'm sure you might know this, if we actually celebrate it in the UK.
Well, we don't. We don't, David. And I don't know why. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that we should celebrate it, because America was a very different situation to over the UK. Should we celebrate it? Well, that really depends on the numbers. What I've struggled with over the last couple of weeks is just trying to find the numbers of the stats of people who are the long-term survivors, the pre-96 who are still alive today. THT don't have them. Public Health England don't have them. So I've sort of come up to a blank, and it might be that there aren't that many. We hear the regulars, the Martin Whittakers, the Tony Whitehead, who's my personal hero, the Julian Howes, but we don't know beyond that. I know that THD has a pre-96 group, but there are about six members there, and perhaps a few more. So I think that we have to have this conversation about should we mark this day before we just launch into it? Because it's very different over here when you look at the histories of the epidemic, and just talking about our NHS system versus the American private system, that raises all sorts of issues. But should we have it over here? Let's have a talk about that.
I think so. I remember this show is a good place to do that. So let's go back in time. So this is 2023. This marks my 30th anniversary of being.
Congratulations! Diagnosed. You're a thriver.
Being diagnosed, thriver, HIV thriver. So you have beaten me by a long shot. When were you weren't even diagnosed with HIV, were you? What were you diagnosed with? Take us back to those days. What?
So I was 22. It was February or early March, I forget, late February 1982, and I was quite ill. I thought I had glandular fever, but it endured beyond glandular fever. Liver was swollen, spleen was swollen, and I probably thought at the time, being this very silly 21 or 22 year old, I'm going to get some more time off work, not realizing the serious of it. So I had also glandular fever, and of course I just felt pretty rough. So I dragged myself off to the GP, who did a prod all over the body, took it quite seriously, called the hospital, Whittington, and I was in there in a bed by the end of the day. And all sorts of tests, liver puncture, marrow extraction, lymph node taken out, goodness knows what they did. But they did every single test. And unbeknownst to me at the time, and the reason why I was put in the side room was because they were aware of what they called at that time GRID, which is gay-related immune dysfunction. And that's what they thought. And it was only after they exhausted every test that the doctor, who I think was fantastic, given what you hear about other sort of medical reactions at that time, he was a fantastic doctor. He said, "I think you have GRID." And of course, given the that I after that I went celibate for 3 years and then got tested, that's for me is very marker of that time. But it was called GRID in those days.
With it being called GRID, do you think it sort of increased the stigma against the gay community and the national press and that?
Oh, there was plenty of gay stigma. Don't forget, we're only 25 years after the 67 Act, so there's plenty of stigma around. And don't forget as well that Heaven opened in 1979, which really put gay people on the map. It was a time in which we really took off as a community. Mm-hmm. So we were winning the battle, if you like. And so anything that came along to beat us back into our closet was applied to us. So stigma, hatred, the loss of it. So it started a long time before then. And do you know what? One thing that I'm so passionate about HIV Long-Term Survivors Day is that we are forgetting the fantastic contribution, the fantastic way with the community came together. We were a fragmented, closeted community in many, many senses until Heaven opened. Then we got our act together and we were in a better place to actually sort of confront this and deal with it. And don't forget, we had 6 years of government indifference before the, was it six, 5 years, I think, before the government had their act out, their advert out, Don't Die of Ignorance.
You were right about the gay community becoming stronger in the early 1980s, and we had gay newspapers like Capital Gay, and they were, I think, instrumental, because obviously it was a time of no mobile phones, no internet, no social media, so we were getting drips and drabs of information from the USA, weren't we, about the deaths and disease.
Well, we were. We were, and I remember there was a program, I think it was a year before, about the gay cancer, and I lived with a flatmate at the time, and he was a bit of a hypochondriac. When he heard about this, he really got his teeth into it. But I think this was London, and even though Laker was at his height in terms of the flights to America, we just didn't take it seriously. We thought it was another way of attacking us. And so it sort of crept up on the community. It was almost as a Chinese whispers. It just grew and it just grew and it just grew until we had a realization. When I was told I had GRID, it didn't quite sink in. Even though in time I had this period of celibacy for 3 years, in the end it got to me, but it didn't sink in because there was nothing about it at the time, very little in the gay US. To actually sort of discuss it. And when you did talk about it in the community, you got a very, very hostile reaction because it was, as I said, we thought it was taking away a kickback at us, and we wanted to have our fun.
Were you in shock when you were diagnosed?
No, as I said, it took a while for it to really to sink in. When I was diagnosed in the mid-80s with HIV by a very, very unpleasant doctor in hospital, in the arse end of the hospital, he said, "You've got to go home, you've got 6 months to live." So what I did was went home and packed a suitcase of hospital essentials. I mean, I should have been, shouldn't I? Because I worked on THD volunteer helpline for a while, and the stories the calls I was dealing with were pretty horrendous at the time. But no, I think I just took it in my stride. Don't ask me why.
So when did you start volunteering in the sector? So for THT, you mentioned.
THT was straight away. It didn't last very long. I think this is what is interesting. I find it so difficult that what I remember from that period, David, is the anxiety, the panic in people's voices, and from those who are actually becoming ill, and it was really hard. I know really hard for me to deal with it at that time.
So you were diagnosed 41 years ago, weren't you? So I think when I was diagnosed, which was 10, 11 years after you, I was aware of this creep of this disease crossing the planet, a bit like what you had COVID. I had forewarning of HIV arriving. You didn't. You were diagnosed with GRID. Do you think that was why you weren't so shocked? So you just took it in your stride because it just happened rather than I was aware of an approaching menace? And
I think you're probably right. We just didn't know much about it. I think the doctor at the time who diagnosed me with GRID said, "We'll keep an eye on you," which they did. But then I sort of, as my health returned to normal, I kind of forgot about it. And then I heard about the THT because I was friends with Phil Cox. He was the first guy who set up Gay Waves way back in the day. And he sort of got me onto it, hence the celibacy, because we were lovers at the time. But you know, you could not in any sense be unaware of the early 80s about HIV and AIDS. You couldn't, because the press was full of the most vitriol comments and pictures, and it was very, very frightening. And you heard all sorts of rumors that Thatcher was going to put up camps for all the gay community, all those kind of things. And this really, really was a sort of a no-goaler for them, because it really spurred the whole community on to get themselves together, really politicize, economize, and socialize this issue. This was this issue made us, and I think as when I break Pride every year, I break because of that, because we did so well. If that makes sense.
So who did you turn to for sort of help, or who did you disclose your status to, or did you keep it secret or private from some people and not share with others?
No, I've always been pretty public about it. I went to university in 87 because I thought, why the hell not? I'm not going to live, so I might as well have 3 years of fun. I told them up front at the university, just said, look, I've got these appointments. I've never felt a sense of, I've been very lucky, I suppose. I've never felt threatened in any way, and nobody's ever threatened me like that. One thing about Capital Gay, though, I was very cross with them at one point, and I said, look, you're just reporting stats and THT's outlook and so forth. There's no personalization to the whole issue. So they said, right, well, this is answering one of your questions. They said, right, Mark, go and write something. So I did, and it was very convenient for me because I could tell all my friends in one go. But I could also address this issue about it, put a sort of a human story to what was, because we are so bombarded with the negative is horrible, and you dirty gay scum, etc. And actually I wanted to put a bit of this is me. I'm an ordinary gay lad trying to struggle to cope with this disease. This is how I do it. And I can't, I don't know what the consequences of that were, but had a lot of phone calls the next day.
Yeah, really. I probably read some of your articles, I think.
Well, I don't know. I did write some. I can't remember what I wrote. I've got a folder of every article I've ever wrote somewhere, and I tried to find it for this interview, but I thought I couldn't find it. But yes, I did write, and I love writing. I've always enjoyed writing, and it was the writing skills I had were particularly useful when I set up my own charity, and this was in the 90s. And this was in, do you want to hear about that?
Please do. Please tell us about it.
So this was in the early 90s, and I'm sure you would remember this, David. This was about complementary therapies. Now, there was a lot of people, I had friends who were going to New York, and they were coming back with hundreds of pounds of vitamins and minerals and taking these things all every day. I had people, friends who were drinking their urine therapy. I had friends who were going to Mexico to the Hoxie Clinic, all sorts of craziness. And I had been very, very simple about the complementary approach. You take what works, you take what has a good reputation, you take an empirical approach to this. And if it works, it works. If you get a result, that's it. And an example of this is I had just before I got diagnosed with AIDS, I lost about four or five kilo in about 2 weeks. It just flowed out of me. It was shocking. And I think that's really when I realized, when it sunk in, how this is serious. And I remember one day trying to leave my flat, and it took about 2 hours. I couldn't stop. Now, in those days, when you were at that position, that situation, you were put into the hospital, put onto a drip. I had so many friends who had been in this, and some had come out of hospital, some hadn't. Some had got thrashed in hospital because they forced these highly sweet drinks and you just get the weight up. I knew about Chinese medicine. I had been seen a practitioner called John Tyndall, who still practices. He's a hero of the complementary HIV scene. And I went to a place in Camden, I think Acumedic, and I told them about my situation. I told them my diagnosis. They gave me medical herbs, and the next day it had stopped.
Wow.
I know, and people don't believe me, but that's it. I don't care what people believe. It stopped for me. And that generated my interest in alternative medicine. What use can it be as an adjunct to staying well? Because we really had very few drugs at those time, medical drugs. There are the DDI, DDC, and certainly AZT wouldn't touch. So I created a charity, and we printed a publication called EQ, registered at the British Library, and it took a sensible approach. It didn't question HIV, so we can't be confused with Continuum. It accepted HIV was the issue, and the premise was, what can you do to mitigate any side effects that you might be experiencing around your HIV status? For example, one of them was about thrush. Now, I don't know if you know anything about thrush, whether you've experienced thrush yourself or whether you've witnessed someone with thrush.
I used to get it. The little white spots at the back of my throat, yeah.
Little white spots is just really early stage thrush. I remember thrush as being a totally esophageal invasive condition. People couldn't eat, people could barely speak, and it was a killer. I was not going to have thrush anyway, and I thought, I'm not going to have this, because after a while you became resistant to fluconazole, and they put you on the much more sort of dangerous but still effective drug, which you could do to deal with thrush, which would come back, but then you become resistant to that. So I looked into that, and I looked into the anti-candida diet, and I was diagnosed with very early stage thrush. This is a thrush. This was a time when I had about 4 T-cells, and that was usually the measure of your health in your immune system. And I went into anti-candida, which is no sugar, no yeast. And I dealt with thrush, and I managed to deal with it. And I never had thrush. And when everybody around me was having serious thrush. So that then, again, spurred me on. Let's talk about more things. So that's why we put the magazine together. We looked at sensible things like exercising, building up your muscle, your bone density, your muscle resistance, looking at an appropriate use of vitamins and therapies, and so on and so on and so on. And I'm really proud of that body of work, because it never claimed to be a cure, but it said, let's see what we can do as a community. And the bit I enjoyed most was editing writers' works, because writers can be so precious about them. But we came up with something that was readable, had a good distribution, and that was taken over by Positive Nation when I decided I'd had enough.
Brilliant. In modern HIV treatment, is just treatment, is not a cure. So if you have a treatment that works for you and everybody and every patient is different, then yeah, go for it, I think.
Well, you've got to remember, this was a time when people were saying, you're nuts. This doesn't work. And you know, this was from the AIDS establishment as well. And it was pretty hard at the time to deal with that. But I was talking about turmeric as an anti-inflammatory way back in the day. And of course, you know, with chronic HIV, ongoing inflammation, even at low level, you want to manage that. But this is what we were talking about. And now it's one of the parts of the mainstream. So I'm not saying that I was a forward thinker. It's just that this was what was available. But as I said, it was really hard to combat other people who are saying, look, you've got to focus on the medical drugs. We did, but not exclusively.
Do you think of yourself as a survivor?
No, I think of myself as a thriver.
I like that.
As a thriver, it's really difficult. PosNation did an article on me years ago, and I didn't know the title of the article until afterwards. And it said, only the strong survive. And I was very cross about that, because I had people who were just strong, just as focused and just as much effort into doing their best, and they yet still died. It's not a question of luck. It's such a complex issue as to why some people survived and some people didn't. I mean, I had a dosed new immune system. I did have conditions that came up, but I managed to get through antiretrovirals. And I think for myself, it was having a purpose. It was understanding my condition, having an excellent relationship with my healthcare provider, surrounding myself with people who had a very positive message. Because you've got to remember, in the early days, David, everything was saying, you're going to die, you're going to die, you're going to die. I couldn't look at the Don't Die of Ignorance advert, because it was telling me I was going to die.
Yes.
Saying you're going to die in 6 months or two. With scheduled dates, you know, 2 years and 3 years. And of course, the industry at the time, the HIV sector at the time they built, were accepted that. Why wouldn't they? I couldn't make my own quilt, because I might as well dig my own grave. And I think if I were to ascribe anything to it, it was surround myself with the right people. I was a director of Positively Healthy, which at that time, very contentious organisation. But at the time, it was absolutely right for me, because it took me out of that sort of doom and gloom. And it said, look, fight for your survival, fight for your life. Yeah. And I think I did. But it wasn't just that. It's such a complex issue. And until we get all the survivors out, the pre-96ers in, and have a chat about it, we're never going to know, is there a common thread? Is there something that links us all together that we did that made that got us to here? I don't know.
Yeah, we can learn so much from the stories that are thriving today. I mean, it's like you said earlier, you're uncomfortable with being called brave. And I on that, because I think it's the brave people are the ones who aren't here. They face things that, you know, were those situations. By plan, design, whatever. We're here today. I think we should get together. We should learn from each other.
If any of your listeners are thinking, well, that's a great idea, David. Let's get something together. Let's start talking. It's not enough. And why this day is so important to me, 5th of June, Long-Term Survivors Day, is because I don't want us to be marginalised. And I think if we got a cure, if we got a vaccine, people with HIV, there is a very real possibility we may be marginalised. We need to be a much, much stronger community, particularly those who have been around for a long time. And I think we need to share our stories. We need to talk to people who are newly diagnosed and get a sense of perspective, which is not to say that they – I come across this all the time – people who say people who are diagnosed today don't have it as bad as we had it. That's nonsense. It's just as bad, because it's a personal diagnosis and you have to face up to so much. The external may be different, but the personal, the internal, is very much the same.
It is, yeah.
And I think we could be such a great asset to those people, but we're just not a visible presence in the UK. And I think, David, the reason for that is because the narrative we've been fed over the years is an entire generation was wiped out. So we have no expectations. And one thing I do recognise is when I talk about my own diagnosis, people are amazed, they gawp, and they think that's not possible. Well, it is possible. And let's celebrate that.
What advice would you give to somebody who has just recently tested positive?
I looked at the disease or the condition, and I understood the condition. So you cope with your condition, you learn about it. Yes. This isn't a cold, this isn't a bit of glandular fever, this is a chronic disease. It's not going to kill you if you take your medication, but there is an impact on this. So learn about your disease, learn about your medication, for goodness sake. Mm. Take your meds on time. The other thing is you need to emotionally cope with this. And this is why Positively Healthy was so good for me, because it helped me through what was a traumatic time. And I think I was, there was one point, David, when I was completely mad, I think, and I think that was a trauma of it. I just came out of it, and the realization that I had got through this, and then remembering everything that I'd gone through and all those people I had died. I never felt survivor's guilt in any, for one second,
yeah.
But I felt an enormous loss, mm-hmm. And that's hard for a young person to bear. So learn to emotionally cope, get the right support around you. And then the practical coping, taking your medication, going to your GP's appointments or medical appointments on time, get into a dialogue with your clinician. This isn't about you. If you don't go for, if you miss an appointment because nobody called you, that's not on the clinic, that's on you. Take responsibility for your condition. It's a chronic infection. It's not a cold. But let me tell you, after 24 years of taking medication, it's so easy. And you guys, we've all got so simple medication, one pill a day for some people, injectables can help.
Yes. Oh, great. That's great advice, Mark. I'm sure our listeners would really appreciate that. Thank you very much for your time. I'd love to have you back on the show. I'm sure Sue would as well, and Josh. Yeah, it's lovely. It's been lovely to have you on the show. And we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you. There was one thing that I just wanted to say very quickly. If I could, if that's all right, it's for people pre-96s or even anyone who's aging. It can't just be about acknowledging our community. It must be about fighting for better care as we get older, not just for long-term survivors who have their own conditions, but people who age anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think the UK, the Age of a UK plan doesn't go that far enough, but it misses one point. We need to take responsibility for ourselves as well, and that's part of managing our care as we get older. Does that make sense?
It does. I mean, because of the medication that we take, we're more likely to get things like diabetes and cardiovascular disease and certain types.
Well, you can't forget the other people who pre-96. We've had facial issues. We have had diabetes. I've got a friend who suffers from osteoporosis. Yeah. We cannot forget those, which are quite specific to those people. And I listened to your program recently, Anal Screening, and I, on the basis of that, David, and thank you very much, I've got my appointment in May. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are specific conditions for pre-96s because of the long-term toxicity of the drug and having HIV for such a long time, if that makes sense.
We should keep talking really about
our... Could we?
So it's been lovely to have you. And we hope to see you again soon. Radio Reverb.
Welcome back to the HIV Hour. That was a great interview. Just to add on to that, Mark said there is a, on the 7th of June, that's next Wednesday, an HIV and ageing conference. Which has been held in New York. New York time, it's 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., but the British time is 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. If you're interested in tuning into that, you can go to the link, which is hlaconference23.eventbrite.com. So that's an HIV and ageing conference. It's called I'm Still Here, Ageing with Purpose. So that's going to be next Wednesday, 7th of June, do tune into that. It sounds like it's going to be really, really interesting. Yeah. So thank you for tuning in.
Yeah, to everyone.
We'll see you later. Take care, everybody.